Anyway, I went back there a couple of months later, and a neighbour came in and said, Martin, said, is anybody living here? And I said, no. I said, nobody should be living here. And so I saw a young man coming out that door over there. This is the door between the house and the garage. And he came out and he said, oh, good evening. He had a black bag under his arm. And he said, oh, good evening, and rode off down the road. I said, it wasn't an orange push bike by any chance. He said, yeah, it was. I said, right, okay, fair enough. I said, that's the bloke that we caught in here before. I went in, and what had happened is that I've missed something. When the officer had him there in front of me, I said, you know, I asked him that he better give me the key to this door at the back. And he handed me the key in front of the officer. And then the phone call with the nephew, who said, oh, let him go, you know, obviously he's fallen on hard times. And he rode off into the sunset, and the rest, we thought that was the last of him. So anyway, when I saw him at the house, because I just turned up there one day as he was coming out the house, and I said, where did you find that key then, to that door? He said, I had it in my pocket when I gave you the other key. But it was only the key to the outside door. What he had done, he actually broken in to the kitchen door by wrecking all the framework. He'd left his tools that he used to break in with at the scene. He'd cut himself, so they had his blood there. There was cigarette butts all over the house, and none of the family smoke, and his fingerprints were everywhere, in every room. He'd gone through everything. He'd dismantled the boiler, he'd taken all the copper out of the house, out of the entire house, he'd even gone into the loft and taken out all the pipe work in the loft. He's done about £15,000 worth of damage to the house itself. To replace the boiler system alone is going to be about £6,000. Anyway, I approached him and I said, look, you've been seen coming out of the house. One of the neighbours had followed him down the road. He disappeared down Castle Avenue, and then they lost him in Pook Lane. And when I notified the police again that it was this chap, they said, okay, we'll arrest him. And this time he had to go to court. And obviously I had to go give statement to the police. I had to go to court three times. And the last time that I went, he was still pleading his innocence. And the judge said to him that, Mr. Hawkins, you were seen going down Castle Avenue on your push bike with a chair under your arm. And he said, yes, I did. He said, but I'd done some work in that house 3 years ago, and I took a chair with me so that I could sit and have somewhere to have me lunch. And the judge sucked it up. And I thought, I can't believe what I'm hearing, because I knew that nobody had done any work in that house, you see. And But another thing that had happened, this neighbour that had seen him come out, she was too frightened to go to court, and he was hanging around outside her house. He didn't threaten her or anything like that. He just made a presence, and it made her feel uncomfortable. The judge wanted to have her arrested to make her go to court. But Chris, the nephew, stood up and said, look, I may live in Shrewsbury, but she is a neighbour of my aunt, and you're not to put her through that. So his solicitor couldn't argue with him, or with her, I should say. And the judge looked up and said, well, Mr. Hawkins, you're free to go. There's no case to answer. And I went, what? No case, how can there be no case to answer? And anyway, he was a free man, he just walked out. And that look on his face when he went out, you could just sort of slap him round the chops, you know. It was horrible to see him walking away.
Right, talk about the sort of present day now.
Yeah, I think I've got something like what I call 60 regulars. Regulars being weekly, fortnightly, once a month, once every 3 months, or twice a year. They come back. Also, a lot of people do their own gardening and they just want me to do the heavy stuff, like the hedges, etc., the scarifying and whatever of the lawns and whatever. But yeah, there's a lot of good people out there, and Rowland's Castle's been good to me.
What's your favourite job?
I like it all. I mean, today we've been doing a 6-foot fence in Cottage Close for one of my regulars, the Sumners, Joan and Bill Sumner. I've been working there for them. Well, they are one of the original four that I started with. Mm-hmm. And you lose people. Every year people pass away or move to a different area, but there's always somebody else that picks the phone up and says, oh, can you help? So yeah, it's roughly about 60 overall. I don't want any more, really. So Rowland's Castle's been good to me, yeah. Really.
Now, tell me about your wife. Where does she come from, and when did you
get
married?
Well, I've been married twice. I used to do, I'll tell you about my first wife, Kerry. I used to dabble in motor racing as a pastime. A friend of mine, one day I bumped into him because I hadn't seen him for quite a while. He'd been going out with a model from London, and he said to me, hey, have a guess what I'm doing. I said, no, go on, tell me. And he said, I'm doing Formula Motor Racing at Silverstone. I said, are you? He said, oh, you want to come up and watch me? And his name was Kevin Moore, one of the local lads from the village. I think his parents still live up by the church, about two doors away from the church. And I said, all right. So anyway, I went to Silverstone with him to watch him practice. And there was a spare car, and they asked me if I was interested, would I like to have a go. I said, well, I've got no money on me, because I knew that everybody had to, all these students had to pay. And I said, well, I've got no cash on me or anything like that. So I said, maybe next time. I made an appointment that there would be a next time. And in the end, Kevin stopped doing it. He finished with a girl from London. And I carried on with it. And we got into, it was Formula Ford, which is the lower end of the, obviously the stepping stone to Formula One is usually Formula Three. So you had to get a bit of experience in Formula Ford first. We had a few races. I never won anything, but I was consistent. And then we had a little dabble in Formula 3 at one time. That lasted for probably a couple of years. But I had very little in the way of sponsorship for that. Even the Formula Ford at the time that I was doing it, which was my early 20s, we were looking at $750,000 per car, and there was three cars in the team. We were sponsored by British Airways. They were in a spot of bother. They were taken over, or Lord King took over the helm at British Airways, and one of the things that had to go was our sponsorship. So it all came to a little bit of a sticky end, really. And finding sponsorship was very, very hard, especially when we were coming up to the first big recession that I've ever sort of lived through, which was in the early 80s. So that sort of come to a sticky end. And the girl that I was involved with was Kerry Knight, who come from Leigh Park, was all intent and purposes a lovely girl, a nice family, got on with her parents really well. We were all very, very close, and I found out we got engaged, was due to be married, got married, and then found out a few weeks later that 6 months before we got married, she'd been seeing somebody else. And I said to her, why on earth did you go through with it? And obviously couldn't come up with an answer. So the marriage was basically dissolved, got divorced, lived on my own for a couple of years. Met Doreen through work at Wingards. Again, she comes from Leigh Park. I went out with Kerry for 5 years and was married for 5 months. I went out with Doreen for exactly a 12 months and we got married. And we've been together 27 years. 28 years, sorry. So you don't have to be with anybody for a real long time to find out what they're like. She's a nice girl, you know, we get on like house on fire, we're complete opposites, so that works well. Hardly ever argue.
And tell me about your children, when were they born?
Dean was born in 1987. And Haley was born in 1988. There's exactly 1 year, 2 months and 3 days apart. Dean is almost finished at university. He was a bit of a late starter because he wanted to join the police. And he put all his eggs into one basket. And I told him, you got to go out, find yourself a job while you're trying to get into the police. Every time the police had an open day at Hamble, which is HQ for Hampshire, they kept telling him, you're the next one on the list. And I said to him, how long's this list? Because nothing was happening. And I said, look, they're offloading coppers, they're not taking on. He wanted to be a rapid response.
Oh, yes.
Drive the fast cars, have the guns, and all this, that, and the other. And I said, look, you're going to be an ordinary copper first. You're hand-picked for that. And that's if you get through the extensive training for that. 4 years down the line, he was still trying, and then one day he came to me and he said, I'm forgetting about the police, Dad. And I said, thank God for that, because he was just sitting at home playing games on his computer. He worked at Booper up at Havant there at the weekends, and apart from that and the odd time down at the hardware store in the village here, he hadn't done a full week since he left school. And I said, your CV is not going to look very good. He came to me and he said, I'm going to go back, finish my A-levels. And I said, good for you. I said, he's a very intelligent lad anyway, and I didn't want him to waste it. I don't want him doing what I do, because he hasn't got the get up and go for physical stuff. He's very, very clever. He's got a good brain in his head. He'd done his A-levels. He'd done enough to get to university. He's taken on a marketing degree, of which he's doing very well.
Where is he doing it?
In Portsmouth. He's got a house down at Portsmouth that he shares with four or five others. Comes home at weekends because he's still working at Booper. His job placement for a 12-month as part of his course was with Apollo fire detectors in Havant. 6 months in, they offered him a job, and he told them no, because he wanted to do his paperwork, get his paperwork. He finishes this summer. They phoned him about 4 weeks ago and asked if he would go in to have a chat about a job when he's finished his uni, and they've offered him project manager. They really like him down there, and he's a clever lad, so he'll do well there. And I said to him, even if it's not what you want, take it. Yeah. The salary is good. You know the people, you know what work it involves. And if you want to move on elsewhere, it's do so, but don't pass up an opportunity like this. And he's accepted it. So He starts in September.
So when he's graduated?
When he's graduated.
He's been,
yeah, basically. Yeah, he's having a, I think he's having a, taken a month out. He wants to do a little bit of travelling. I mean, last year, him and his, for the summer holidays, him and his friend went to Thailand. And they went all over the place. And I think they fitted everything that Thailand's got to offer in 8 weeks. Thoroughly enjoyed himself. And that's like, basically the first time he's been out of the country on his own as well. I mean, well, I know he's in his mid-20s, but even so, it was a big adventure, and he had a brilliant, him and his mate had a brilliant time. So I think there's something like that on the cards the month that he's taking out.
And Hayley?
Hayley, she's not quite so academic as Ding, but right from about the age of 4 or 5, she has wanted to be a hairdresser. Struggled at school, done enough just to get into college at South Downs, and then she romped away. Done the courses there, I think she was on a 3 or 4 year course, one or two. Came out the other end with flying colours. Started working for Cabello's in Emsworth, and then while she was doing that, she was putting herself through college to do nails, waxing, the full beauty treatment, and then went out on her own and has never looked back. She's as busy as you like.
She's mobile.
She's a mobile hairdresser, come beautician, and she's into everything. She does everything that women have done to them, she does. She also does the tanning, and everyone's got all the equipment and put her heart and soul into making a good little business for herself, and she's got a lot of regular customers. We've got no worries about her whatsoever. She got married 2 years ago to Matthew, who's a fully qualified electrician. He's had a bit of a colourful colourful life. His dad was one of the paras that went out to the Falklands, and he was in the lot that went into Goose Green. And I think Matt wanted to join the paras, but he got into a little bit of bother a few years ago, which he's sort of ironed himself out now. He's a nice lad. His dad, or his parents, are divorced. His dad is remarried and lives in Norway. And for the lot, first part of Matt's life, he grew up in Norway, so he speaks the language fluently. And he's just an all-round nice guy, likes his sport, especially football. He still plays football, he plays cricket, and heavily into sport, big time. If any football on the team. With Stansted, obviously I've been involved since I was 8 years old, and I saw it there when Lord Besborough, I know we've got a Lord Besborough now, but it's only in name. But when the old Lord Besborough was living there, it was a whole different setup. It was like the old gentry, because you had the butlers, the chambermaids, the cook, the chauffeur, and all the secretary, and all people that you remember as a child. And now there's nothing like that, because obviously it's in the hands of the trust now. Not a bad thing. I mean, James Cooper has been one of the best people to look after the place. He's doing a great job. Michael Pryor, the head forester, we didn't get on with him very well when he first appeared. There was a little bit of friction between the shooting crowd and Michael, but now we're all good friends. We have to mediate with him to actually do the vermin shooting, because we have to carry paperwork with us in case we're approached by people. The only thing I'm upset about is, well, say I'm upset about it, I look at it in two aspects. Because I remember it when most of the forest was shut off to general public because of all the pheasants that they had there. Now, I want people to enjoy the countryside, and in a way I'm pleased that they have opened it up so people can go out into the forest. But the aspects of all the dogs running around out of control, where there used to be a lot of game running around, now there isn't. We get the blame because of the shooting. They say that they never see anything, so you should stop shooting. Well, that's okay, but if you put your dog on a lead and come up early in the morning or late in the evening, you'll see everything that you want to see. You see every species of owl up there that this country's got to offer, all the deer.
Do you ever see partridge?
This partridge there. You may see the odd covey of English partridge. You don't see them wild ones, especially. You may get the odd few that have been bred and are flying around in a small covey. You do get the red legs there because of the local shoots around Stansted. There's pheasants, you have nightjars, plenty of woodcock and that sort of thing that you see in the evenings and what have you. You've got to go to certain places to see certain things. In Ladies Walk, for instance, you have the badger sets there. A few years ago they had a white one in there. I don't know whether it's still there or not, but we used to go up there and watch them in the evenings, coming out of the sets and playing around and what have you. But we used to, when Les Buckle, the gamekeeper, and Jack Pryor, the game, because they're the only two gamekeepers that I was ever involved with. The other four gamekeepers were retired off just a few years before I started going up there. I know them, or knew them, they're all passed away now. I knew them, but Les Buckle and Jack Pryor were the only ones that I was ever involved with myself. When the shooting season had finished, there would be a couple of weeks grace so that they could catch up all the birds for breeding, because they used to rear all their own. And then we could start our vermin shooting after that, which usually finishes the last Saturday in March, solely because all the birds and that are starting to breed and what have you. And the last thing we want to do is disturb all the summer visitors and what have you. The only other shooting that we used to do up there was at the end of May, two evenings in 1 week. We used to go up there to shoot the jackdaws, because they used to fly into the pheasant pens and nick the eggs. So the less jackdaws there were, the better. So we used to go to a particular wood, completely surround it, and then somebody else would go in the wood and tap the trees with sticks to make them fly out of their holes, and then we used to shoot them. And that was good fun. But once the pheasant shooting finished there, that was all stopped, because, well, it was a bit pointless going out shooting them when there was no need to, really. But we used to go all the way up to all the way over to Racton when we were doing partridges, and used to walk all the fields across waving your stick or a flag or whatever to make the partridges fly. And yeah, we used to have a lot of fun there. You used to be able to walk through the woods and catch rabbits with your hands, because there were so many around. Or everybody used to carry like a thumb stick, where with like a fork at the end, where you could, if you saw a rabbit just sitting there, you could just pin it to the ground with your fork, and then you got your dinner with no shot in it. Yeah, but yeah, it used to be great fun. And then they found the dormice in Stansted. So this end, particularly the sling all the way through the forest side, is designated as a site of scientific interest because of that. You can go up there early in the morning. I walk up there early with my dogs. I can, on a Sunday morning in the summer, I can be up there at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. It's lights, everything is running around, and you even see things like mandarin duck that fly into the big oak trees, and they can be 60 feet up in a hole, and they'll have their young ones up there, and you just watch them jumping out and bounce on the ground and get up and run after mum, and things like that. You know, now we've got the kites up there, we've got ravens back that have been, well, the Victorians more or less persecuted a lot of the birds of prey, didn't they? You know, buzzards, etc., etc. We've got a lot of buzzards up there. There's quite a few kites getting about, and there's been a pair of ravens for the past 3 years, and they bred at the Racton Tower the first year, and then they were at one of the gatehouses in a big old spruce tree last year. This year they're in the Douglas firs. And you can tell it's a raven, because they got this real rasping croak about them when they want to let you know that they're about. So we leave them alone, because we don't see many of them this way. So, but you can go around the lakes. You can see like reed buntings, all sorts of warblers. You go up there, sit quiet, you'll see everything that you want to see. You have muttjac deer, roe deer, seeker and fallow. We used to have red deer up there. I can remember seeing one of the last red deer stags in Ladies Walk. They tell me that there used to be red squirrels there years ago. And some reason why we, you know, would like to see some more back, but until we get on top of the greys, there's pointless in doing it. I'd like to have a captive release program with pine martins. That's a little bit hit and miss, because I haven't mentioned it to anybody as yet, but they're a good way of controlling grey squirrels, but they also, they're an apex predator, so they will go after birds, they will go after eggs, small mammals as well. So I mean, they're a little bit of a dodgy carnivore to have running around. Although they're arboreal, so they're in the trees most of the time, they will come onto the ground to get pheasants' eggs, etc. And basically that's why they were wiped out from this area years ago. Around the lakes, including the woods in Woodbury Lane, we have a bird breeding program with nest boxes. One day when we were shooting, one of the lads said that you don't see many three-toed tree creepers about these days, do you? I said, well, no, you don't, but I said, they are about. I said, we can do something about it if you like. We'll put some nest boxes up for them. And we've had a little bit of success with it. Obviously, we had to ask Michael if we could put bird boxes up, which he was in agreement with, as long as we didn't nail them to the trees. So we had to wire them in place. We've got bat boxes up there, and that sort of thing. So, you know, everything we do is voluntary.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the shooting. We don't pay for it or whatever. It's just a voluntary thing. They let us do it, and we're very privileged.
They don't pay you for it.
No, we don't want paying. We're just privileged that we're allowed to walk the estate for a couple of months of the year. Yeah. We can go anywhere we like and basically do what we like. Obviously, there's 7 or 8 of us that go out at a time. No more than that, it's too dangerous, because we have to surround a tree, and we only shoot up. We're not allowed to we don't shoot on the ground. And we don't invite other people to join us, because we know one another like the backs of our hands. We know that we can trust one another. And when you have one squirrel jumping out, yeah, it's very exciting. They know where they're going. They want to get to the nearest hole possible, and it's, although we've got shotguns in our hands, it is easy to miss them. But when you get a dray where 6 come out all at once, it's like World War III kicks off, and everybody's jumping around really excited, but everybody knows where everybody else is.
Yeah.
And I'm very sort of proud of my team.
Can you name them?
I can name every single one.
Would you do so?
Yeah, we have Barry Yates. We have Dean, my son. We have Rory Hooper. Terry Barber. Michael Edney. Not the Edneys from West Marden. Mark Roberts. And we did have up to now Brian Cook. But unfortunately, he passed away last year. He was a great source of entertainment. He had a dry wit, which everything was to do with the dockyard. He was a scientist in the dockyard. If the Navy had a problem with a gun on one of the boats, he would be brought in to work out why it had a problem. And unfortunately, he went down with dementia, and he went down really quick. And last, just before Christmas, we lost him. So
that was great.